Well, hello, friends. This is the beginning of Adventures in Identification number 3 in series 2. About a year ago, I did the series 1. And what I'm doing is just taking some seed thoughts, some evocative words, some series of evocative words, and pondering on them, and trying to shed light upon them so that we may come to the point where we are beginning to alter our habitual consciousness and transform it into something more prescient, where in which revelation of the hidden unity more easily comes to us. I've been working with this word soul, S-O-L-E, I-A-T-S, yats, I am the soul. And that is the fundamental realization that I am the one. It is a trite statement in the upon the lips of many and in the writings of many. It has to be realized, and the imagination has to be employed in the realization, to let the imagination span far beyond the immediate ring, pass, nod, and environment, and to feel one's participation in this expanded, in what the expanded imagination reveals, to feel one's participation in what the expanded imagination reveals. This is what we seek to do. Of course, that imagination can expand into the solar system and beyond, into the starry vault of the heavens. And these are simply revelations of the senses or of the expanded senses. There are also revelations that can be found on the subtler dimensions, and whatever is encountered, there is but one consciousness encountering it, the soul, S-O-L-E. I'm doing that because of the reminder value that it has. When we say the word soul, S-O-U-L, we may not think expansively enough, but there is one S-O-L-E, soul consciousness throughout cosmos. One. And wherever we are, we are part of that experiencing consciousness, even though it seems incredibly remote. There really is no there in a certain sense. There's only one point. There's a point, one point of being consciousness in the entire cosmos. We can explore later whether that point is superimposed by an infinitude of points which have existed and will exist, whether the one point that is our entire universe is the same point that is all of an infinitude of universes, superimposed in apparent time and superimposed in apparent space, but maybe it's just simpler to think that there is but one perceiving point with a multitude of apparent points within it, all of them emanated into varying degrees of circumscription. We can say that the one point has multitudinous points within it, all of them emanated into varying states of circumscription. The one point, the universal point, that which is the universal logos, is the freest of all and the least immersed, although it is in a way immersed into its own self-perception, which is an infinite limitation upon the absoluteness from which it emanated. I am the soul, Iyats. I am the soul. The soul identity, the only identity, the only consciousness, and in my particular state of prakritic immersion, I, apparently a point within the greater point, in a certain condition of circumscription or encapsulation, circumscription, let's call it, or encapsulation. So I do not register in my state of encapsulation or circumscription all that the entirety of the soul registers. I register as a emanative extension of the one. I register only a tiny part, but as the retraction occurs, which is equivalent to evolution, I register more and more until I realize that I am the soul self. We'll put it that way. I am the soul self, the only self. Now, these are just words until we gather some intimation of their truth. So I am the soul self. And I look for that soulness in all, trying to detect the soulness in all. That all diversity is really one thing. Look for the soul in all. Look for the oneness in all. As if all beings are really representatives of the one. Can we look, detect, register anything and see it as the representative of the one? So we'll ask ourselves, can any thing be seen, known, registered as the representative of the one? And not only the representative, but the one itself? That is a big question. It takes practice. Just for a moment, look at anything before you. We'll do these little meditations as we go along, can one be so much in this oneness that anything registered whatsoever is seen not just as a part of the one, but as the one itself? And this is based upon the idea of the indivisibility of the essence. The boundless, immutable principle is indivisible. Division is a kind of change within it, but it's immutable. It is what it is forever. So in anything that presents itself to our consciousness, the entirety of the boundless immutable principle is present. It's God all in all in every apparent part. I think I'll put that in. God, well, it's the big God, all in all, in every apparent part. But we are so used to looking at parts and variety and multiplicity that the unifying principle, the only one thing, is lost to sight in the multiplicity. So the first thing in this way of thinking, we might say, is do not lose the one because of engagement with multiplicity, with the many. Do not lose the one because of engagement with the many. Our goal here, may the soul be liberated from its misidentifications. This, in a way, is the universal process. Every universe is an engagement of one consciousness with reductions of its true nature, objectified reductions of its true nature. And they are in varying strata. And we have to disengage from those objectified reductions. We have to, in the universal process, disengage from our objectified from our self-objectifications. I'll put it that way at the moment. In other words, we see, as an emanation, we see apparently smaller and smaller aspects of the self we are. And we have to successively disengage from those aspects and follow the line of retraction upward, inward, words fail, until we manage to disengage from every self-objectification and return as a retracted extension into our own pure universal selfhood. And even that is just a step in the universal process because there has to be a retraction of the point. At last, at the end of the universe, there is what can be called the retraction of the point. The retraction of the point. The universe is a point radiated forth as the one ray of the Absolute. And that point is allowed apparent continuation in time, for a time, for a certain duration, which may or may not be real. And then when the universal creative process is over, it is itself retracted into the source of all sources. So in our everyday evolution and our spiritual progress, we are in a state of retraction, disengagement, disidentification. Let's have some words for that process. Retraction is disidentification, disengagement, detachment, elevation, centralization, centralization in that which we really are. It's different from the kind of personal centralization that to which that word is also applied. You know, our everyday consciousness is so engaged with multiplicity. As I talked about in the last program, I sometimes use that sound S to remind myself of the sameness which permeates all contents of consciousness. Our key is to, our key process is to reduce MULTP. I'm going to, let's see, MLTP. I'm going to make that kind of a one of those words, MLTP, multiplicity, because I'm going to be using it a lot. MLTP, multiplicity. So our key process is to reduce multiplicity to sameness, while not losing the practical perception of multiplicity. And this is, this really goes against the grain. This is a problematic act. And, you know, to be able to somehow live one's life doing this and still being practically effective is sort of the acme of the dual life. It's called the dual life of discipleship, but we might as well call it the dual life of the initiate, or of the very high initiate, or of the planetary logos, or of the solar logos. The dual life, where sameness resounds in all perceptions like the pedal tone of the Hindu music, and yet a great variety of multiplicity is dealt with effectively, never losing the sameness and never losing the practical touch with the multiplicity. I guess there seemed to be fighting a little bit the technicalities here, but I'm trusting that my faithful editor will help me remove these little technical glitches. Baniel Anieg. Well, I feel the echo of old magical words here. Being all, nothing is ever lost, and nothing is ever gained. So, all loss and gain are appearances, not realities. They are relative loss and gain. And that's because we are the all. In this case, we are the all, which is the absolute. We are the all. And the definition of the, well, one of the ways of considering the absolute is that nothing can ever be added to it or subtracted from it, because it is infinitely infinite. So you cannot subtract from infinitude. You cannot add to infinitude. Well, I mean, maybe Georg Cantor would differ with that. But he specified all different manners of infinitudes. And I'm talking about the ultimate infinitude, the infinitude beyond which there can be no infinitude, the infinity of all infinities. That's actually what we are, essentially. We have the potential to self-objectify endlessly. But we live in a world of loss and gain, you know, like the second house of the astrological chart, and the eighth, in a way. Death of the eighth is a big loss. We lose the vehicle. And normally, what we desire, the gain of that or the loss of that, is indicated often at the second house. And we imagine that we lose and we gain. But because we are the entirety itself, to which nothing ever can be added or subtracted, there is no real loss and gain. All this is of me. It has all come out of myself. Anything that I register in consciousness is an objectification of what I essentially am. And within myself is utter completeness. Of course, we have to act as if loss and gain are realities in our relative worlds, because we're working in limitation, and we're trying to build a configuration which is archetypally perfect, because pre-designed within the emergent point that is every universe. That in itself, of course, is infinitely removed from the infinity of all infinities. The infinity of all infinities. Yes, maybe I'll also, let's see how I might do that one. Infinity of all infinities. And infinity of all infinities. Hope I'm spelling that correctly. So that's the ultimate infinity. The infinity of all is the ultimate. Which does not mean it is in any way listed. Well, we are that. So essentially we realize that anything that we perceive is really an objectification of a tiny aspect of the complete infinitude that we are. I guess it seems almost paradoxical to talk about a complete infinitude. I'm speaking of the absolutely perfect. That out of which anything and everything and anything that ever could be can arise. And maybe in some strange way has arisen forever. That gets into some difficult concepts. That the future, you know, that all potential futures have forever been realized. Or in some way pre-exist their emergence. But, you know, in a practical way of speaking, it doesn't hurt to think nothing is ever lost and nothing is ever really gained. Maybe I should put, it's the idea that nothing's ever really lost. Many things are apparently lost and apparently gained. But they are the merest infinitesimal fragments of the self-becoming which has made them, or generated them, or put them into apparency. Maybe this would be the time to look at, this is rather down here a bit, but I'm going to lift it up here to a higher place. Here. And I'll say, I have already lost an infinitude of universes. Well, I guess that puts things into perspective if we could only believe it. You know how Master Moria comments on the idea of how people lose control when they lose the slightest thing and they lose their emotional control. And they become panicked and disorganized. I've certainly done it myself, you know. It just says, just look at the average person searching for something lost. Not a very dignified picture, is it? Not a very dignified picture. But is anything ever really lost? If the self, which has become all things and has the potential to become all things, can never be lost, then nothing can be lost. So, I'll put that down. If the self, which has or will become all things, is permanent, then no thing can be lost or gained, because it's really the self which has become those things. The self has become those appearances, those things. And there is no thing out there, really. There is only the the self in disguise, masquerading as an object or a limitation of itself. So, Ihalaiou, Ihalaiou, how should we pronounce that? Not sure that will be so useful. Well, okay, seeking then to review, what is our attitude when we have lost an entire self-objectification we call a universe? What is our attitude when we think that all we have self-become in the apparent past has been the objectification of that self-becoming has been dissolved forever? What is our attitude when we think that we have not lost only tiny examples of self-objectification, such as anything is, but the entire self-objectification called the universe? Do we really feel a sense of loss? Are we? It's almost a humorous kind of question, but do we feel any loss for that which has been lost in previous universes? Granted the correctness of the secret doctrine with this endless sequence of universes caused by the great breath, we probably don't even feel much loss for anything that was lost 10 lives ago or 5 lives ago, unless it has been something extremely impactful, such that it is making an impact on our present life in an unconscious manner. I would say that the memory of such self-dissolving, or the dissolving of self-objectification, is not with us, nor we do not care. And just imagine going 1,000, 2,000, 100,000, a million universes ago. It's just as if no loss ever occurred. And that is, of course, because the substratum of all self-objectification can never be lost. The substratum of all self-objectification can never be lost. It is ever what it is. It is the utter completeness. And so it's as if certain images that have been projected have vanished, but the original from which the projection occurred still remains. So, the practical part of this is to think of our attitude toward loss and gain in our present life. And we hold certain things as so important. We lost our home, a child, a partner, even our life, our physical vehicle, it all dwarfs in comparison with entire universes vanished, and we, the one consciousness, were inevitably present in that vanishing, that dissolving of the universe, that projection which came from the infinity of all infinities. So it puts things, you know, in perspective and perhaps contributes to our sense of detachment. I know sometimes I've gone looking for a pen or a pencil, you know, something important, a pen, let's say. Important to me. I've turned the house upside down for it and have not succeeded. And there's this feeling of loss. It shows that I am not concentrated within my essential nature, that I'm not being my essential nature, that I don't realize that out of me all these things have arisen. And perhaps when that occurs, it's time to shift our perception and to become very quiet and to remind ourselves of who or what we really are. And the same for gain, you know, people become excited about wealth, power, the acquisition of powers and so forth, as if something is really being added to them. Well, in relativity, it is so, because relativity is based upon limitation, and in the world of apparency, something is being added. Additional contents of consciousness are appearing. But of course, in terms of one's essence, there is no real gain, and all that is gained will be swept away by the pralaya, which is the withdrawal of the point as the retraction of the ray of the Absolute back into the Absolute. Obviously, relative language is going to distort. What we really need is the sense of the presence, that thrilling presence which somehow supports all we do within this world of phenomena and reminds us of the creative process in which we are engaged. So I have already lost an infinitude of universes. All aggregates, deaggregate, all that comes together falls apart and is resolved into the essence which never changes. So this next point, do not seek enlightenment amongst aggregations. Or we might say that while clinging to aggregations, enlightenment cannot be found. The growth of illumination in the emanated extension we call ourselves. Greater light cannot be found when we are holding to the phenomenal world of things that come together and fall apart. All that aggregates will be deaggregated. And then, conversely, all that is deaggregated will once again aggregate under the spell of illusion. A universe is what? A universe is an aggregation under the spell of illusion. course, it's hard to think aggregations are illusory because, in a way, all we have is a point. The universe is simply a non-dimensional point in which a multiplicity of phenomena seem to arise. It's an immeasurable point in which the illusion of dimensionality within the point, let's put it like this, within the point, the illusion of dimensionality arises. But when the point is retracted into the pointless, all dimensionality ceases. Well, as I say, we live so much in the world of dimensionality, the dimension of time, the dimensions of space, that it's hard for us to think in terms of non-dimensionality. Hard for us to think that way. And it requires a great labor, at least at first, to try to think that way, that all this which seems to occur is a vanishing illusion, which has to be dealt with, of course, by that consciousness which arose out of the only thing that is. It is necessary to deal with the illusion. What is it said in this third ray, Blessed One stanza? All is illusion, O dweller in the shadows. All. What a statement. All is illusion, O dweller in the shadows. Come forth into the light of day. Display the hidden glory of the Blessed One. So we are constantly being encouraged in our teaching to develop detachment. I guess it helps when we realize that everything from which we must detach is a self-projection. So I'll put that down. Everything from which we must detach is a self-projection. I'll just keep the word with one capital S. It's ultimately a self-projection. But for practical purposes in the universe, it's a one capital S will do. A few more points, perhaps. Well, maybe I'll leave that one, you know. There are a few things here that are really difficult. And I've had so many interruptions in this program already that it breaks one's concentration slightly. How does a now happen? Well, you can kind of wonder whether, see, when this question implies that a now is a moment. But maybe there are no moments. But what if there are no moments succeeding each other? As if a now were a measurable moment, but maybe not. Maybe just the way the great being or the factor of being, succeeds only itself and continues to be only itself, perhaps the now cannot be divided. Maybe the now is indivisible. So let's put that down. Is indivisible. And non-momentary. As if there were many measures, you know, if the now is momentary, then there are many measurable nows. But what if the now is not measurable? What if the now is equivalent to eternal duration? And that all there ever is now. Then we come to the idea, nitot, you know, now is the only time. I think we're going to have to throw out our language. Maybe language is only contributing to confusion. Now is the only time that there has ever been. So you have this sense, in a universe, of course, there are moments, because that is part of the great illusion, that there should be time and moments is part of the great illusion. That is the way the illusion is arranged. But ultimately, perhaps there are no measurable moments whatsoever. In any universe, there are, within relativity, measurable moments. At least that's how the illusion is set up. But in the ultimate sense of the word, there may be simply this one now. Can we even call it an ongoing now? A continuous now? Well, maybe we can call it that. Maybe there is one continuous now. And always has been, and always will be. And it's the same now. The same now that has ever and always ever been and always will be. The eternal now. The same now. I'll stop putting those single quotes around it. It's too cumbersome. The same now that has ever been and always will be. Now, that's not so helpful when dealing with time and space and the practicalities of the illusion. This does not help when dealing with the practicalities of the great illusion, i.e., the universe. The universe is the great illusion from this perspective. Any point is an illusion. And the great point, which is any universe, is the great illusion. Only when God is all in all, only in the state of absoluteness is there no illusion. Illusion is based upon multiplicity and movement, I would say. Illusion based upon multiplicity and movement and division. And in, you can't really say in, but you say as that, the nameless, there is none of these. Or at least our definition of that requires that there not be multiplicity, movement, or division. So can we discover or live in such a way that we are aware of a continuous now? It's filled with creative potential. And it's the, what is the now? In this way, perhaps we can call it the point of self-becoming. Now is the immediate point of self-becoming. Through this now, all that we are is in flowing objectification. I mean, of course, our language is a time-space language. And I guess what's necessary is to have this break the mind, in a way, from its limitation, conceiving of beginnings and endings. There are beginnings and endings in the production of the great illusion, a universe. But there's also something other. This ongoingness, the focus in being, the focus as being, which has always been and will forever be. And if we could just get the sense, well, you know, let's see, if we could get the sense of the continuity of being, the momentary nows would disappear, and the now would appear. Or would register in our consciousness. So that's what's one of the things we have to do as we attempt to break through the tyranny of time or to eradicate the tyranny of time. And to realize the identicality of all nows. All apparent nows. Don't know where I went there. What I want to say here is the identicality of all apparent nows. I could just find my, here we are. Identicality of all apparent nows. I guess I'm using little now to mean momentary now. But the true now is ever identical with itself. Self-identicality. The little apparent nows are known by different configurations perceived. The little apparent nows are known by different kaleidoscopic configurations perceived. What makes this moment different from another moment? Well, different things happen. There's a different pattern, a different arrangement. But then, of course, the mind is differentiating according to objectifications. And if there is the sustained being, then we sense that all those different moments have somehow been occurring at the same, simultaneously. It's a difficult thing to break through the illusion of time and space. Some, you know, will require drugs and other things that will alter the brain chemistry. But I think we should, you know, we can think our way into it, and we can make our own drugs, so to speak, inside the brain. I think that the right kind of alignment produces the necessary ingredients to change the brain chemistry. So, this is the only now that has ever been or ever will be. This is the only now that has ever been or ever will be. So, let's call it let's call this now, really now, the non-configurational now. Non-configurational now. In other words, its qualities or quality or nature does not depend upon the perception of configuration or pattern. A non-configurational now. And then really it's only configurations which differentiate one moment from the next. Only configurations differentiate suggest to the perceiver that there is one moment and the next. But if there is no concentration upon configuration, then the now remains ever the same. Same. Well, you know, I know it can be a little laborious. As I say, I've been interrupted a number of times in this discussion. I just have to allow the thoughts to flow. Not knowing exactly what will come up or come down. But this idea of the non-configurational now is maybe a new form of wording for me and tells me something about how to differentiate the momentary now from the ongoing now, in which being abides. See, the ongoing now and the continuity of being, they go together. I'll put this in here. The ongoing now and the continuity of being are related. With continuity of being, one has, one perceives, or let's say registers, the ongoing now. O-N, ongoing now. On and on and on. And then, along with that, is time and configuration. Being and time do not agree. Time is. Being descends to create. How does it go? This is in discipleship. Discipleship 2, page 285. Being descends to manifest. Creation is. Creation is. Time then and form agree. Being and time do not agree. Time then and form agree. So when there's multiplicity, there's time, there's form. There are apparent moments because of registered patterns, consciously registered patterns. But when we have such a consciousness that can, while seeing the patterns, dissolve them as if they were not, then being and now persist. That book, I think it was by Ram Dass, he said, Be Here Now. It's a profound title. Of course, it has great philosophical implications. It also simply advises a person to be present in the moment, registering without prejudice that which is occurring. It can have a practical expression as well as one that is deeply philosophical. I think what I'll do then is say that this is the end. End, imagine, ends. So this is the end. Yep. And we'll do it this way. The end of Adventures in Identification number 3 in series 2. And the beginning of Adventures in Identification number 4 in series 2. And if there has appeared in this program a little bit of discontinuity, I apologize for it. Sometimes I was called away from the computer for a long time. And then when I, don't smile, you'll freeze. Okay. All right. Yeah, no, maybe not. This, I think the image is just a little bit too big, and that's why the screen is freezing. But maybe, you know, when you turn it off, it's going to be okay. So what we're trying to do together is enter into a state of mind accompanied by a state of consciousness in which the one becomes more real than the many, which are actual. And it's my hope and purpose to have such a field of energy around these discussions that it induces this realization in the patient viewer, listener. So I think that will be sufficient for the moment, and we'll see where we go when we start number four in this program. And we'll see you soon. Soon? In another moment? Shall I say, see you now? Just the way space seems to be extended. We call it extension philosophically. It's the appearance of space. So time appears to be extended. But the truth is, that extension is an illusion. And maybe it's more difficult to grasp, but the extension of time is also an illusion, which means that it's a presentation to consciousness while in that condition we call universe. That is illusion. That which is presented to consciousness while in the state called universe is essentially an illusion, though it's a very actual illusion, and it's a necessary illusion. Well, a little more later. Bye-bye.